Hey, so we just released the first part of Volume 1 of Thief in the Night, an ongoing commentary on eschatology, a conversation between myself and Pastor Brian Wolfmuller here on Raw turned into a transcript. We've released Part 1 of Volume 1 as an ebook at Amazon.com. You can find it by Googling The Search for the Real Last Days. It's only $2.99. It's only 45 pages long, but it's the first of what's going to become this longer volume series, which we will release in paper as well once we get more than 45 pages at a time. These things cost, so far, this one cost me $80 out of pocket, plus I would say at least 10 man hours of my own editing to make sure it was clean and readable. It looks really nice, and if before this episode you were a supporter on Patreon, you got it delivered to you as a PDF for free. That's right. If you support me on Patreon on any level, the $1.25 an episode, or what I like to see more, those $5, $7, $10 an episode gifts, then you got this for free. And I will continue to do that into the future with all of the releases of various things. Revelation Unleashed is also in the works. It's going to take a lot more work than the conversation between myself and Pastor Wolfmuller. But even so, support me on Patreon and you will be getting the ebooks for free. The paper, well, when they come out, you're going to want to buy them yourself anyway because you're going to want to give them as gifts. Aren't you? That's right. All right. I'll stop wasting your time. Except I do got to remind you, I'm going to Germany next June, the 1st through the 11th. I didn't look at the dates again. It might be the 1st through the 12th. This is with wolfmuller.co/reformation501. We're going to tour Lutherland. We're going to do some devotions and singing and study and conversation and worldview development. I mean, it's like Bible study with me for 12 days in Germany. I mean, well, you know, if you can go, why wouldn't you? wolfmuller.co/reformation501. And if you haven't signed up for my newsletter, The Resistance, it's going to be changing. It's going to become The Best Use because that's the name of what it's really kind of come down to. You might have noticed I've been experimenting with a lot of different mediums lately, just trying to figure out, you know, what sparks my interest. And I think this newsletter that comes out once a month on the first of the month, you're going to like. It not only develops a little bit of a worldview discernment, first article, how do we live now, kind of point of view, but also tells you and shares with you some of the best stuff I've found out there that just randomly has improve my life. Everything from the squatty potty, and I kid you not, you really want to look into this thing, all the way down to what I believe about cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. So you can find the back issues of this newsletter by going into your browser, typing http://bit.ly. This is just bit.ly if you know bit.ly. bit.ly/2hy1ue1 and or just look in the show notes and you'll be able to find a link to those back episodes and as well you subscribe for the upcoming newsletter. I really think once you get it, it's going to be one of those emails that you're glad to see and you're going to want to read it every single time. But that, you know, that's just me, and if not, well, that's cool too. So David had what I can only call a very hard life. There are a lot of good things. I mean, in most lives, I mean, unless you're a slave in like a galley like Spartacus, right? You have some good things in life. And to be sure, David getting to be the king of Israel brought about some temporal comforts, right? Creature comforts, if we can call them that. But that was only on the other side of what I just can't imagine being in. A situation in which his close friend, his own king, wants to kill him. And in which his religion, his authentic childlike faith in the word of his God, has told him, has declared him that he can't defend himself. At least that he can't really fight back. He can run. He can hide. But that's it. Otherwise, he's just supposed to sit there and wait. I mean, it can't even have started off very, very good. I mean, how's it have to feel? You're a child. You're a boy. You're a big enough boy that you can tend your father's flocks out by yourself in the field, and that you can even take out a lion with your staff and your sling if you really have to. So you're not five, right? But you're young enough that nobody respects you. You're young enough that when the prophet comes to your family commune and says, "Hey, Jesse," to your dad, "I need to talk to your son about some stuff. God's got some stuff planned." That your dad doesn't remember that you're there, right? So you're that guy in the family. You're the bottom of the totem pole. You're out in the fields, what, 10, 12, 14, somewhere in there, dealing with the sheep. You know, you feel pretty good about the fact you killed the lion the one time. You might, you know, have carved yourself a little flute that you play as you hang out there. And, you know, there's worse things in life than being able to walk through nature all day. But then, you know, here comes someone running from the family. You know, David, David is kind of how you would say it in the Hebrew. "You got to come back. You got to come back. The prophet is here." "What? Huh?" And you get there and everybody's there. Like, everyone's lined up. All your brothers are there lined up and they're all kind of angry looking. And you're like, why is everyone looking so upset? What's going on, right? But they're all, you know, and just put the pieces together. These guys thought they had a chance to be king. Ha. And they didn't. Because of David, right? So it's not a Joseph scenario, but it's almost a Joseph scenario. So I'm just kind of looking at you kind of funny, and the prophet says, "There he is, there's the king." And he pours out a thing of oil over your head. It's, whoa, hey, you know, it's not quite like the splash of Gatorade at the end of a Super Bowl game, but yeah, it's kind of like that, only it's oils, doesn't come off. Well, I guess Gatorade's pretty sticky. It doesn't come off easy. "You're the king now." "Well, that's great, isn't there already a king?" "Oh, yeah, there's already a king, too. God's rejected him, but he's still king for now. But you'll be king after him, so don't sweat it." Right. Here I am, right, what, 12 years old. Family's going to be like, okay, this is cool, brother's king, but what's up with that? And what, are we supposed to go to war? No, we're just supposed to, what, serve the other king right now? And then David will be king someday when this other guy dies? What about this other guy's son, Jonathan, who's killed all of the thousands of the Philistines and been protecting us? We're supposed to go fight with him. They just gave us a call to go deal with this group from Gath. What about all that? Oh, the Lord will take care of it. You just wait. But the Lord has promised. You're next, David. So everyone kind of forgets about it, right? I mean, it's just like, okay, we'll send the other guys off to fight in the war. David, you stay with the sheep because whatever. It's David. And the prophet, I mean, you know how prophets are. They're a little eccentric. He might be mad. He's kind of getting old. He wasn't really happy that we had this king thing in the first place. It's sort of like it's post his time and all that. But then you got the whole thing where David's got to take lunch to his brothers or some food, some supplies. And he goes up there and bam, David and Goliath. It all just kind of falls into place. But think that before you get to David and Goliath, what's he doing? He's sitting in the presence of Saul. Saul the faithless. Saul who once had been faithful, who had believed the promises but had rejected them in defense of his own righteousness to say that it is the prophet's fault that things have not gone right, not my fault. God, don't you blame me. And God says, oh, really? Okay, fine. You want to see how much I can blame you? You're done. I'm going to rip it from your hands and give it to another. That guy is sitting in front of David as king. Does he know yet that David is the one to be anointed after him? No, probably not. To the level that, I mean, he doesn't even kind of recognize him standing there. And this is doubly insulting in that David, who does play music, and when we know this, he's already been in Saul's presence serving as a musician because someone heard him play and Saul had a demon that was sent to him instead of the Holy Spirit because of his rejection of the Lord. And he's kind of going mad from that time to time. And so David plays and kind of soothes Saul. And yet when he comes before him to say, I'm going to go fight the Philistines, Saul's kind of like, well, who's this kid, right? So like he knows who he is, but he doesn't. From what I can see, he doesn't know at this point that this guy is actually going to be his heir. But David's sitting there playing this music for this guy who he knows he's supposed to replace. I mean, how hard would that be? Right? I mean, can you imagine with me on this? You got to watch a madman who gibbers in faithlessness and doesn't believe the promises of God rule over your people. And for the moment, he seems strong, but it's going to get worse and worse and worse in terms of his ability to actually lead, his ability to actually shepherd the people. You got to sit and watch, and then you got to give your time, your best effort to soothing his madness. And to, when he won't fight in the name of the Lord, to doing it yourself as a 14-year-old boy, kneeling before him as Goliath of Gath is across the way, shouting insults, blaspheming your God, whom you, in childlike faith, trust in. And you can hear him roaring across the battlefield. You're, look, Saul, we have a God on our side. I'll go if nobody else will, but you can't say it like that. And yet in the back of your head the whole time, you also know he doesn't deserve to be king. And not only do I deserve to be king, the Lord has told me, I am. I will be. But wait. Now, the whole five stones in a sling knocking down Goliath, we'll have to do that some other time. It is such a phenomenal little event. One of my favorite pictures of all time. In fact, I'll probably try to use it for this for the picture for this podcast, now that I think about it, is an image of a woodcut of David, the boy, having used Goliath's sword, which is just massive, to chop off the guy's massive head. He's standing on the body, holding the head in the air with the troops of Israel around cheering. It's the kind of stuff I wish we put in our Sunday school materials, honestly. It's just like, look, this is something a young man, an 8 or a 10-year-old boy, you know, he likes Thor, yeah? This is his religion, to believe that's what Jesus is going to do to the devil. And then David did it to Goliath. Oh, it's just so good. It's just so good. Anyway, but you know that story, so we don't need to go there too much. What you know, but you maybe haven't thought about, is how David then befriends Jonathan. Now, just get this. In their world, what this means. This is the guy who, by all rights, is the next king. Even though his dad's insane, he's not. He's a good man. It's not just he has an awesome name. You know, I mean, it is. It's a great name. But aside from that, he's a good man. To the level that when Jonathan does learn that David is anointed king by the prophet to be next after his father, Jonathan believes. I mean, golly, what a moment of truthful trust. If someone came to you and, you know, at your parents' death, right, with the will, and basically the executor of the will is reading it, right, and you're there and your sister's there and your brother's there, and they say, and everything is left to Jim from Cambodia. And then Jim from Cambodia walks in and he sits down and it's all been left to him. He smiles at you. Hi. Sorry. How'd you feel? I mean, this is more than that. This is the kingdom. Ha! This is the covenant promise. Jonathan just takes it and befriends David. Now, how hard has this got to be for David too, though? Because what does he know? What does he kind of know? I mean, they don't know Jonathan's going to die. Exactly. But it's not good. I will rip the kingdom from you and your sons. It's not a good prophecy that they know is coming their way. And yet this is his friend, his close companion whom he loves. In the kind of filial, brotherly love that we almost have all but forgotten about in our age, where we sexualize everything, right? So the liberals want to go and say, look, they were homosexuals. Just, yeah, okay, whatever, dude. You ever have a friend? It was a tight bond. A band of brothers. And yet all along he has to know what a threat lies before his good friend. What a threat he is to his good friend. Now the place where things really start going bad between Saul and David is not when Saul learns that he's been anointed to be the king after him. It's simply when some woman comes out. This is a little ways down the road. David's been out with Jonathan fighting, and he's having even more success than Saul did leading the armies. What is he, 17? It's like Alexander the Great, right? He's having even more success. And some woman comes out and she starts singing. Saul has struck down thousands, but David tens of thousands. Oops, and Saul was right there and he heard it. And now, well, so you see the madness of Saul. You see the self-righteousness of Saul. He was very angry. And you gotta think this is like building up in him, right? All night. You ever have bad news, like right before you're supposed to go to bed? You open your email. You never should open your email before you go to bed, by the way. I wish I kept this law more often, but that's always when that email is going to keep you up for 3 hours comes, right? Just wait for the morning. It'll be better in the morning. But so Saul's got that, right? They've gotten back from this big celebration party where everyone's cheering the other guy. And it's just grinding at him all night long. And the next day he gets up and he's getting one of his fits is coming upon him, right? The spirit of evil is tormenting him. But this is a reality that's also centered in David right then, right? And so, but David's there because David's still the guy who plays the music for you because he's the only one who can actually soothe you and calm you down. And so, but it's not working and you're getting angrier and angrier. And so you grab your javelin and you just hurl it at him. And now imagine you're David. You're just sitting there playing the lyre, plucking on the music. And if you're a musician, you know how this is. You get into it, right? Like you lose time and space. You're just, the melody carries you. You are the instrument. And next thing you know, I mean, in the middle of the high of that music, the javelin tip of a spear clatters off the wall like an inch and a half from your head, right? Crack, smack, boom, you're up and like, what's going on? And there's the king and he's got another one in his hand and it is coming at you too and you dodge to the side and you're running out the window, getting away and Saul's screaming and raving and throwing stuff. Saul, your king. Saul, your Messiah, your Christ, your one whom God has promised will lead you until his death. Even though you are to be next. David had a hard life. The same guy comes back and says, hey, marry my daughter. I mean, what? Dude, hey, my friend, there is a pattern of psychological unwellness between us. We have an enmeshed situation. Our family system dynamics don't look good from this point. Are you sure we should be having Thanksgiving dinner together? I'm a little nervous about this. And even amazingly, I mean, this is to marry into the lineage of the king, though, too. Crazy that, right? This is to be one who might inherit the kingdom through a number of deaths, untimely, which you kind of know are going to happen. Whoa. And then the guy actually does a switch up on you, doesn't give you the daughter he said you're going to marry, gives you another daughter. And I mean, I guess it's okay because she's just like all into you. Like she thinks he is just the most fantastic guy in the world. She's infatuated. But see, you know how that kind of relationship usually goes? Infatuation is not a good foundation for a marriage. It usually, when it flips, when someone who's your greatest fan stops being your fan, it's not like they just become not a fan anymore. You know, it goes the other way pretty far. But it pleases David to be the king's son-in-law because, look, he knows what's coming. And this is like, I can see how this is all going to work out nice kind of moment. Saul's going to make me a son-in-law, and then something will happen maybe later in life, and poor Jonathan can't be here, and Mahash-Bahaz is going to have some trouble. But at the very least, I can see how God's promises are going to be fulfilled through this. So why not? He marries her. But David keeps winning in battle. At the moment, she loves him, and Saul actually kind of sees, oh, wait a minute, what did I just do? I just gave him power. I thought I was going to create a snare for him and cause trouble with his war and all this. I just helped the guy. So Saul gets even more upset. This Christ, this king, this leader, this authority that God has put over you, David, he tries to kill you again. This time he goes about it a little more carefully. He sets a plan. He premeditates the murder. But, I mean, kind of an idiot here. Blood is thicker than water, so I guess that's why he trusted his son. But see, his son is a true friend to David. And so Jonathan, hearing about the conspiracy to kill David, comes and tells David that this is going to happen. Now, again, put yourself back in David's shoes. You just married, you married the guy's daughter. And you're winning wars for him. And as much as you know you're going to be king next, you are in good faith doing all that you can for him. And then his son, who's your buddy, comes and says, you got to leave tonight because he's going to kill you. And it's not just himself. You got to leave. How does that make a man feel when that kind of news comes? And this happens more than once. I mean, it's a pattern. It's a habit. It happens again and again. Mikkel lets him off the hook one time. Now, I honestly don't know, and if someone ever wants to email me this because they know the little place where it's hidden, I'd love to hear it. I don't know when Saul figures out that the Spirit of the Lord is literally going to give David the kingdom. He figures out pretty early that God is with him. He's like starting to put two and two together. He's like, wait, God said he's ripping the kingdom from me, and this guy keeps growing in power and might and strength and popularity and all this stuff. So somebody kind of figures out God's with him, but when does he actually know that the prophet has anointed, has Christed David? I'm not sure. I don't know. But at a certain point, this all just kind of flips. And again, the conspiracy gets too big. Jonathan helps David escape. David flees. You got the whole bit with him. And now he's got, you know, guys around him. He's what is he, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, somewhere in there. He's got a band of people who trust him, who are going to trust him more than the king. And yet he's saying, we don't do anything against the king, ever. We're just going to leave, right? They leave. You got an endless string of flights where he is being pursued then by a larger army, led by this man who is his king and friend, who has now become, again, his greatest enemy, where he's living out in the wilderness with a rock for his pillow night after night, so starving that he breaks the laws of his religion, that he eats the bread of the presence in the tabernacle as they go by. This is blasphemy, according to the Torah, but he has no choice. They're that hungry. Now, Jesus, you might remember, actually says, I prefer mercy, not sacrifice. And so I put him in that situation. He had to eat. I provided the bread, right? So but from David's perspective, though, what's he doing? He's losing everything, and he's losing it for years. Years. He ends up having to go and serve the Philistines. And then in the midst of serving the Philistines and being like a double agent, pretending to serve them while protecting his own people against their invasions, and just think of how terrifying that would be day in, day out, the risk to his life at a constant moment when they would figure out, I like watching, you know, spy movies, The Bourne Effect and all that is great stuff, but would you really want to be that guy? I wouldn't. That's the life he's living. And then they can't find out that he's done anything wrong, but they actually start to think he's a double agent. And so then you got to go and pretend to be mad. You literally have to put spittle in your beard and roll around on the ground like you've lost your mind so that they just kind of walk away from you. Then you got to flee. You got to get out of there. All this because one day you're playing music under the sun, watching dad's sheep, and some prophet comes along and pours oil on your head. All because you believe that prophet and that oil is bigger than a man and some, you know, olives. That there is this true God active by means of great and precious promises in this Ark of the Covenant, the sign of circumcision and the sacrifices of the Passover. You believe all that. And so through all these things, you cling not only to the promise of circumcision, to the promise of the lamb which you eat on that Thursday night as a sign of God's desire to save you, to not let Sheol have you. But through all of this, you do believe that you will be king. Now, this is not a faith without doubt. This is not a faith that never questions. When you go down and lie down to sleep on that rock, and the armies of Saul are on the other side of the hill, they don't know you're there, you know they're there, but you got to sleep tonight. I mean, it's not like your stomach isn't churning as you say, Lord, have mercy. I'm trusting what you say. I don't see it. I don't see how I'm going to be king, but you've said it. Why is David a man after God's own heart? It's that faith alone in the promise. He lies down, terrified of man, but trusting God yet. more. This is why when David has these two opportunities to kill Saul, to lift his hand and bring about the fulfillment of God's promises by his own works, he refuses. Because he knows still, and this is pretty important, right? He believes that Saul also has this promise. And so if God gave him the kingdom, God gave him the kingdom. If God said, I'm going to rip the kingdom away, then God's going to rip the kingdom away. Doesn't need me to do that for him. If he says he's going to give the kingdom to me, well, then that's what he's going to do. I will let it be. I will trust in the promises that have been given to come to pass. And there, Christian, you have what you can believe today. For you have not been given circumcision, and you have not been given the Passover, and you have not been told that you will be the king of a little nation called Judah. But you have been washed with holy water in the name of God. You have continually given to you a feast of feasts beyond understanding and yet tangible, a new creation, a new world to come, a new resurrected mankind with creation and the cosmos itself flowing from his heavenly body. You've been given to eat and join and commune, come and unionize with that. It's been declared to you that God has divorced your sin from you, your sinisterness from you, as far as the east is from the west, according to the crucifixion of a single man on a hill outside of Jerusalem. There is no greater evil than to think that you will now lift a finger to make that promise come true. And so David cuts a little bit of cloth off the back of Saul's shirt, and he feels terrible about it. That was too close. I feel like I'm doubting there. But Saul, my father, again, remember, think of the emotions, the humanity in this. My father, I've married into your household. I have never wronged you. Why do you seek to kill me? Is that you, David, my son? He's such an ass. Lying, hypocritical, backstabbing, confused, self-righteous prick. Excuse me. It's raw, so deal with it. That's what he is. Saul is yeah. That he would call David his son in response is just abominable. Now, he's got a little bit of a guilt, but it's not a healthy guilt. And he doesn't even stop after this. He still pursues. David has to flee to the Philistines again. You know, it just... So imagine. I mean, I'm angry thinking about it when I put it in those terms. So imagine being David. How angry would you be? And if you have any kind of conscience, how hurt would you be? And all your officers are saying, do something about it. All your trusted friends are saying, look, you've got the kingdom given to you. Do something about it. How tempted would you be? And let me bring you back to one more thing, especially as you watch Saul corrupt and lose the kingdom. As you watch him fail to protect the widow and the orphan. As you watch him gather the wealth to himself and yet be unable to lead his troops to defend the borders against those pagan, nature-worshipping, radical barbarians on the borders. If you have any heart at all for your neighbor and any ability as a man of war to protect, if you are a police officer or a military man, and you have to watch the one above you, or even at the very top, absolutely scuttle and crash the entire system, how much would you not be, at the very least, desiring, praying, that your chance would come sooner than later? That God would give you the staff and make you the shepherd of Israel. Now, I don't think I'm making this up, the struggle that David's having. I think it's in the texts. Consider Psalm 36. It's not one of the well-known ones. This isn't 23 and 1 and 118. And hopefully by now you kind of know those three, I hope. The curse of an alienation from God and the blessing of fellowship with him from the hand of David. That's the editor's remark as to the title, but he says, an oracle of transgression hath the ungodly within his heart. There is no fear of God before his eyes, for it flattereth him in his own eyes, in order that he may become guilty, in order that he may hate. The words of his mouth are evil and deceit. He hath ceased to act wisely and well. Evil doth he devise upon his bed. He taketh his stand in the way that is not good. He abhorreth not evil. Now, yes, this is definitely, we can apply this to the sinful condition of humankind. Paul does in Romans 3, the wickedness of the children of the world. But who is he talking about? Who is David thinking of as he describes this evildoer? I'm going to read a little bit of it again, and I'm going to try to pull it apart. But listen to the deep-seated indignation in David's voice. This is not some philosophical discussion about sin. This is a direct line to someone who has rejected the Spirit of God and is using all of that rejection, pouring out that evil, that separation from God, on David. He is describing a man who has fallen, who has been alienated to the fullest extent from God. And so he says, come, be my son. But he means ill to you. He says, come, be my musician, but I mean to kill you. He says, come, lead my troops, but I shall pursue you. The words of his mouth are evil and deceit. He is driven by the madness of the spirit sent upon him. He hath ceased to act wisely and well. He plots with his counselors that he might invite you to dinner and murder you there. Evil doth he devise upon his bed. On the night before he would go to battle against the enemies of God, he takes counsel with a witch from Endor. He taketh his stand in a way that is not good, and abhorreth not evil. Why? Why? Because an oracle of evil is in his heart. That is, when you don't have the word of God with you anymore, all that you have is your own heart, which has no fear and flatters you in order that you might teach yourself how right it is for you to hate, in order that you might convince yourself that the good thing to do is to harm, to protect and promote yourself, even if it means being utterly blind to the one who is for you all along. Now, that's the first half of Psalm 36. The rest of it turns to David's recognition that while Saul has chosen this path for himself and all that that means, David will continue to trust in God's promises rather than in his own self-justification. O Yahweh, to the heavens doth thy mercy extend, thy faithfulness to the clouds. Now, what is the faithfulness? Remember, these are the words. Circumcision, Ark of the Covenant, Passover feast, anointing by the prophet. These things are faithful. Thy righteousness is like the mountains of God. Thy judgments are like a great deep. Man and beast dost thou preserve, O Yahweh. Right? So God, you're over all things. You're the biggest, you're the greatest, you're the total, most in control. It's all very, very simple and nice. But how precious is thy mercy, God, that the sons of men find refuge in the shadow of thy wings. They become drunk with the fatness of thy house. And thou givest them to drink from the river of thy pleasures, for with thee is the fountain of life, and in thy light do we see light. Now notice the feasting images there, right? That the entire presence of God is seen as a grand party. That seeking refuge from what we see around us in the Word of God. And remember, David's, think of him lying with his head on a rock again, about to fall asleep. What is his hope? His hope is the Word of God. He knows that his future is to become drunk with the fatness of God's house. I just love that language. It's so counter to how we think about anything today. First, we see you're either like a total roaring drunk or no alcohol is kind of the way a lot of people look at it, right? So as opposed to wine is being given to gladden the heart of man, that it's fine to partake. And in a party, you certainly will. In the feast of the world to come, by all means, Jesus will be drinking to the fruit of the vine with us, which is going to be wine. But he's not drunk on the wine. He's drunk on the fatness of the house. Now, this fat here, this doesn't mean like bad. This means good. This means a chunky, good piece of meat. Think of some good ribs, right? There's some fat in there and it's tasty. Think of bacon, right? Now it's not bacon that he's talking about. He's like the whole house of God, the whole demonstration and provision is full of the best, so that it overwhelms you and you lose your mind in the goodness of it all, even as you drink of the river of God's own pleasure. What pleases God? What does God feel when he's pleased? That is what's going to be poured out on you from this fountain of life. Now just take a moment and step back and remember how they shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat, for the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water. He will guide them to the fountain of life, even as he wipes away every tear from their eyes. The end of the song of Revelation, which is not the end, it is only beginning, it is only the early summary of what it means to believe that the four horsemen of the fall have been collaterally destroyed in the upheaval and destruction of creation itself on the day that Jesus died in his body, which is now risen so that you are clothed with a white robe of his righteousness. Now that's the seven seals of Revelation and their result, which plays on both this word, fountain of life, right? Living water, immortalizing water, but also what it means to be the shepherd. The shepherd who puts what God has said above what men would see. So that just as David was willing to be betrayed by his friend and to allow the evil of mankind to do what it must do, trusting in the surety of the plan God had set, for the sake of shepherding the people and restoring Israel to what God had promised it would be, so Jesus of Nazareth, betrayed with a kiss, goes to the cross to allow the kings of the world to kill God in order that he might shepherd the sheep into a better pasture. Now, this shepherding language, it does come initially from David being taken from the flock and put over the flock of Israel, and God speaking in those terms when he then promises to David later, when he is on the throne, that the throne's going to pass to his son and never pass away, so that the lineage is definitely going to come down to Jesus from there. I took you from the flock. Will you build me a house? I'll build you a house. But see, that shepherding image then becomes part of what it means to be the king, part of what it means to be the king of the Jews. Psalm 80 picks up on this as well, and it's quite lengthy, and so I'm not going to be able to dig all the way through this, but there's some really strong imagery running through here, which is going to also connect to, again, Revelation chapter 7, the latter verses. They are pulling on this view of twofold, the party that lasts forever and leading the sheep into good pasture. Shepherd of Israel, oh, give ear. You who lead Joseph like a flock, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. Before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh, stir up thy warrior strength and come to our aid. O God, before us, restore us. Cause your face to shine that we may be saved. Yahweh, God, Lord of war, how long will you be angry with your people's prayer? You give us tears to eat as bread. And you give us tears to drink in great measure. Now, I'm going to stop right there, but notice the promises we believe. Everything is going to be done for us, and yet we don't see it. We see tears instead. And yet, what does the shepherd, who is a lamb on the throne, do? He wipes away every tear from the eye. You have made a strife to our neighbors. Our enemies mock. God of war, restore us. Make your face shine that we may be saved. The rest of the psalm goes on to play with the image of a vine growing in a field. And Isaiah's vineyard is not even been preached yet, right? But you get the Isaiah's vineyard kind of imagery going on there. But all of this is to call God the shepherd who will give good pasture to his sheep. And of course, what would any of this be without Psalm 23, that the Lord is my shepherd and I shall not want? He prepares a table before me in the presence of my enemies. And don't miss the connection of that moment to David eating the bread that he shouldn't have eaten in the tabernacle while he flees from Saul, that God actually gave him food. His banner over me is mercy. Yeah, his banner over me is the promises. And it is empowered by those promises that, yea, I may walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Again, think David's lying down on one side of the mountain. Saul's on the other side of the mountain. He is in grave peril. He may walk confidently through that valley and fear no evil, for God's name is with him. His head has already been anointed with the oil of Christness, Christianity, promise, and covenant. Only prosperity and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Again, to believe it to be true even when you see that it is not. To see that it is not and maybe could never be, and yet to believe it will be true. David had it temporally as a promise and walked silently, peacefully into it. Through pain and torment and trial and suffering and doubt, you have it as an eternal promise, which is better by far. How much then shall the sufferings of the present time compare to the glory that's going to be revealed? In the last day, all the days of your life, you shall be followed by mercy, and you will dwell beside still waters. You shall lie down in green pastures. The sun shall not strike you, nor any scorching heat. A reference to another phenomenal psalm, Psalm 121, where probably not David, probably a song of the exile, as the sons of Korah were cataloging and gathering the ancient texts and making sure they stayed preached by the priests that were there, all without a temple. What hope did they have? They had the hope of the promises of the prophets which had come before, that they would be restored to the land. And where was that hope going to come from? It was going to come from the land itself. And so they say, I lift up my eyes unto the hills. From where does my help come? That is to say, I look from the rivers of Babylon across the great desert to Jerusalem, to the mountain of God, where once there had stood the ark. And I wonder now, where do I go? What do I have? Since my religion has been taken from me. No, it has not. My help comes from Yahweh. My help comes from the Lord who created heaven and earth, and he indeed will not suffer my foot to totter. He indeed still remembers his promises. The keeper of Israel, the keeper of the promises of the covenant, he does not slumber nor sleep. You got to lie down with your enemy on the other side of the mountain, but he watches all. The keeper of Israel sleeps not, and this keeper is yours. Closer than the shade at your right hand. I love this. Hold out your hand. Look at the top. Look at the bottom. See how it's darker on the bottom where there's a little shadow there? Yeah? God's closer to you than that. So that by day the sun shall not smite thee. There's our bit for Revelation 7. But you got to love what comes next. It's not the sun shall not smite thee, nor any scorching heat. It's the sun shall not smite thee, nor the moon by night. But what, huh? How's the moon going to smite you? Well, just think about that late fall, early winter, where you went out without the coat that you needed, and it was sunny, so it was okay. But then the sun went down, you were inside, you came out, you don't have your coat. The moon's up, and man, is it chilly. Yeah? That's what it's talking about. God shall keep you from all evil. He shall keep your soul, your life, your nephesh, your eternity. He shall keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. Because he is your shepherd, this lamb seated on the throne, who has been given authority to open the seals. And in opening the seals, show you what is behind what you see. What you see is one thing. And certainly, you can see the ravaging of famine and sickness and death and warfare across all ages. But you are given to believe that the upheaval of this present age, upheaved most in the body of one man who, by letting it join with him, crucified it in his wounds. The Lamb who breaks these seals is breaking the barrier between what God says and what we know. And he's reuniting that reality. He's bringing the Word of God back to you in himself, so that clothed with his own blood, his song becomes your song. Like the sons of Korah, you will be before him day and night, and he will shelter you with his shepherding presence, so that the fatness of his house causes you to never hunger again, and the living water which pours from his gifts will cause you to thirst no more. The gentle light of his face, which will lighten all things, will never strike you, and the damp chill of the winter's cold will never touch you again. For he, Jesus the Christ, their King, in the middle of all that is, will be your shepherd. He will guide you to everlasting good. And though in this darkness you have cried, though through this valley of the shadow you have mourned, you shall never have a tear to wipe away again. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Now, this is a debatable point. Is the seventh seal the seven angels? Because now we're going to move into the second seven. Third, depending on how you count. Is it seals, angels, censers? There's three sevens. They certainly form a pattern, but then you also have the pre-seven of the seven letters. I'm still going to call the angels the second seven. But are they the seventh seal opened? Or did the monks get it wrong when they numbered all of this? Should, when the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour, be the end of chapter 7, and then verse 8 starts with a, then I saw seven angels stand before God, and boom, a whole new thing happens. Now, part of what causes me to wonder this is because if John were to be consistent, which Eastern cyclical writing isn't always, although he's so particular. So if John were to be consistent, then the seventh angel's trumpet would be the bowls of wrath, the seven bowls, the third seven, and that doesn't happen. So it causes me to wonder, maybe we just started getting this wrong. Maybe we're overemphasizing what we're looking for. Maybe the fact that the seventh seal opens and all it is silence in heaven for about 30 minutes, whatever that means. Maybe that means a lot. Maybe that's the whole point. Maybe. That's the final stamp. As if one were to look upon a raging, choppy sea in which Tiamat, the god of chaos, reigns and say, be still. And the water became crystal clear and smooth as glass, with not a single rebellion on its waves. In the same way one might look upon the results of four horsemen of evil unleashed upon all of it, so that all things are breaking, so that the sun turns to darkness and the moon fails to give its light and all things crash in fire and gloomy darkness, one might look upon that radical, loud, gnarly chaos, and then under the blood of the Lamb hear a sudden, eternal peace. And that's enough. That you don't need any more. More, even me talking now, more breaks the peace. It breaks the silence. And the silence in this moment is the goldenness of eternity. It's the hope of the end of the world. That's it. Quiet. Quiet. One of my favorite prayers in the church, colics that we pray sometimes. Ask the Lord that we might live peaceful and quiet lives. Isn't that what you want? Reminds me of a now not as popular comedian because he made some bad decisions. Wrote a book called Parenthood and made some jokes about parenthood that are still pretty funny, regardless of his indiscretions. But at one point he says, parents don't care about justice, they just care about quiet. Which, if you've ever had to deal with your kids fighting over some piece of plastic that you'd rather throw away, you know what he's getting at. Don't underestimate the power of silence from heaven's perspective when contrasted with the chaos of the preceding six seals. Now, this would make this silence, this shalom, this peace, one of three images of the end of the world, which are not about, I have shouted this from the rooftops and I will still keep doing it. It's not about trying to see how the world's going to end. We're not talking about that now, but the three sevens in Revelation, they're not roadmaps for what happens before the world ends. They're descriptions of what's going on right now because of the fall, of how it's answered in Jesus' cross, and what will result when he returns. There's no, like, what to see before he returns other than the chaos, yeah? But the description of what happens after he returns, that is here. And it is going to move from this momentary silence, this 30-minute peace, to becoming an endless, permanent reign of a man born of woman who casts down the dragon and rules from a mountain to a city on an everlasting mountain coming down from heaven itself, in which a rider upon a different horse, pure white, with a two-edged sword in his mouth and the name of everlasting written on his chest, scatters the darkness and leads us into a perfected forever. Now, feel free to disagree with me on this. I really don't mind. I could be wrong, but I'm gonna go with that when the Lamb opens the seventh seal, there is silence as being the fulfillment of all things in the most beautiful, cherishable, possible ways. So that for me, to imagine paradise is to imagine a slow, warm morning, waking up without the sound of an alarm clock. I might hear a gentle breeze in the leaves of the avocado grove that I hope to tend and work on, and I'm not kidding, I mean that. I might hear that gentle breeze, but it is not loud. And I rise and I go about my task of checking my avocados. Are they ready? Can I make some guacamole or some oil for the passersby who are on their way to Zion today? Yes, this one here, this will do. There's no rush, there's no haste, there's no busy, there's no traffic, there is silence. And yeah, the voice of my friend breaks the silence, but not in a way which breaks the silence. Only in a way which shares it with me. Now, I don't think I'm entirely crazy in making this up, and I do believe there's actually an Old Testament connection to this as well. The 30 minutes for half an hour part, less so. This is more like it's not a long time, it's not a short time, it's just the right time. It's in the middle of time kind of thing. So I don't know, I honestly don't know about 30 minutes. But I know about the silence. In Isaiah chapter 47, where God is declaring through Isaiah the fall of Babylon, the end of the great evil empire, the end of sin. He shouts, "Come down to the dust, O virgin daughter of Babel." That is all evil, right? You're going back to the dust. "Sit on the ground without a throne, Chaldean daughter. For men no longer call thee delicate and voluptuous." That is, there will be no more hope in an age of decay. "Take the mill and the grind meal. Throw back thy veil. Lift up thy train. Uncover thy thigh. Wade through the streams." Right? Go ahead. Try to be as sexy as you can. "Let thy nakedness be uncovered. Even let thy shame be seen. I shall take vengeance and not spare." The Redeemer, God of hosts, the Holy One of Israel, is here. "So therefore, you great evil one," Isaiah 47, verse 5, "O Chaldean daughter, sit silent and creep away into the dark. For men shall no longer call thee lady. Bereavement and widowhood shall come upon you in the fullest measure, in spite of all your attempts at sorceries, in spite of the great abundance of your witchcraft, in spite of the wickedness in which you trust. Your wisdom and knowledge will lead you astray, and misfortune and destruction will fall upon you." So that the yapping maw of the evil dragon, the wild ravings of the mad king, who from his rebellious throne has hurled spear and chaos against all that is good, even, yes, against those who patiently wait for the promises of the Lord, the gift of God to you and to all who have hoped in his coming, will on that great day of the dragon's destruction be to force that rambling, raving, mad king, that daughter of wickedness, to finally be what? Silent.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes, and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.